I took hour-long naps in the supply closet under the stairs during my lunch breaks. Napping is such a childish word, but that was what I was doing. The tonality of my night's sleep was more variable, generally unpredictable, but every time I lay down in that supply closet, I went straight into black emptiness, an infinite space of nothingness. I was neither scared nor elated in that space. I had no visions. I had no ideas. If I had a distinct thought, I would hear it, and the sound of it would echo and echo until it got absorbed by the darkness and disappeared. There was no response necessary, no inane conversation with myself. It was peaceful. A vent in the closet released a steady flow of fresh air that picked up the scent of laundry from the hotel next door. There was no work to do, nothing I had to counteract or compensate for, because there was nothing at all, period. And yet I was aware of the nothingness. I was awake in the sleep somehow. I felt good, almost happy. But coming out of that sleep was excruciating. My entire life flashed before my eyes in the worst way possible, my mind refilling itself with all my lame memories, every little thing that had brought me to where I was. I'd try to remember something else, a better version, a happy story maybe, or just an equally lame but different life that would at least be refreshing in its digressions, but it never worked. I was always still me. Sometimes I woke up with my face wet with tears. The only times I cried, in fact, were when I was pulled out of that nothingness, when the alarm on my cell phone went off. Then I had to trudge up the stairs, get coffee from the little kitchen, and rub the boogers out of my eyes. It always took me a while to readjust to the harsh, fluorescent lighting. For a year or so, everything seemed fine with Natasha. The most grief she gave me was about ordering the wrong pens. "Why do we have all these cheap, clicky pens? They're so loud when you click them. You can't hear this?" She stood there, clicking at me. "Sorry, Natasha," I said. "I'll order quieter pens." "Has FedEx come yet?" I would rarely know how to answer that. Once I'd started seeing Dr. Tuttle, I was getting in 14, 15 hours of sleep a night during the work week, plus that extra hour at lunchtime. Weekends, I was only awake for a few hours a day. And when I was awake, I wasn't fully so, but in a kind of murk, a dim state between the real and the dream. I got sloppy and lazy at work, grayer, emptier, less there. This pleased me, but having to do things became very problematic. When people spoke, I had to repeat what they'd said in my mind before understanding it. I told Dr. Tuttle I was having trouble concentrating. She said it was probably due to brain mist. "Are you sleeping enough?" Dr. Tuttle asked every week I went to see her. "Just barely," I always answered. Those pills hardly put a dent in my anxiety. "Eat a can of chickpeas," she said, "otherwise known as garbanzos, and try these." She scribbled on her prescription pad. The array of medicines I was accumulating was awe-inspiring. Dr. Tuttle explained that there was a way to maximize insurance coverage by prescribing drugs for their side effects rather than going directly to those whose main purposes were to relieve my symptoms, which were, in my case, debilitating fatigue due to emotional weakness plus insomnia resulting in soft psychosis and belligerence. That's what she told me she was going to write in her notes. She termed her prescribing method eco-scripting and said she was writing a paper on it that would be published soon, in a journal in Hamburg. So she gave me pills that targeted migraine headaches, prevented seizures, cured restless leg syndrome, prevented hearing loss. These medicines were supposed to relax me so that I could get some much-needed rest. One day, in March 2000, I returned to my desk at Ducat after a visit to the infinite abyss of the supply closet and found what would light the path toward my eventual dismissal. "Sleep at night," the note read. It was from Natasha. "This is a place of business." I can't blame Natasha for wanting to fire me. I'd been napping at work for almost a year by then. Over the final few months, I had stopped dressing up for work. I just sat at my desk in a hooded sweatshirt, three-day-old mascara caked and smeared around my eyes. I lost things. I confused things. I was bad at my job. I could plan to do something and then find myself doing the opposite. I made messes. The interns wrangled me back on task, reminding me of what I'd asked them to do. What next? What next? I couldn't imagine. Natasha started to take notice. My sleepiness was good for rudeness to visitors to the gallery, but not for signing for packages or noticing if someone had come in with a dog and tracked paw prints all over the floor, which happened a few times. There were a few spilled lattes, MFA students touching paintings, once even rearranging an installation of shattered CD jewel cases in a Jared Harvey installation to spell out the word hack. When I noticed it, I just shuffled the shards of plastic around, no one the wiser. But when a homeless woman set herself up in the back room one afternoon, Natasha found out. I'd had no idea how long the woman had been there. Maybe people thought she was part of the artwork. I ended up paying her $50 out of petty cash to leave. Natasha couldn't hide her irritation. When people walk in, you make an impression on my behalf. You know Arthur Schilling was in here last week? I just got a call. She thought I was on drugs, I'm sure. Who? Christ, study the roster. Study everybody's photos, she said. Where's the packing list for Earl? Etc., etc. That spring, the gallery was putting up Ping Shi's first solo show, Bow Wow Wow, and Natasha was up in arms about every little detail. She probably would have fired me sooner had she not been so busy. I tried to feign interest and mask my horror whenever Natasha talked about Ping Shi's dog pieces. He had taxidermied a variety of purebreeds, a poodle, a Pomeranian, a Scottish Terrier, Black Lab, Dachshund, even a little Siberian Husky pup. He'd been working on them for a long time. He and Natasha had grown close since his cum paintings had sold so well. During the installation, I overheard one of the interns whispering to the electrician. There's a rumor going around that the artist gets the dogs as puppies, raises them, then kills them when they're the size he wants. He locks them in an industrial freezer because that's the most humane way to euthanize them without compromising the look of the animal. When they thaw, he can get them into whatever position he wants. Why doesn't he just poison them or break their necks? I had a feeling the rumor was true. When the dogs were set up, the wires connected, all the electric cords plugged in, Natasha killed the lights and turned each dog on. Red lasers shot out of their eyes. I petted the Black Lab while the workers swept up the dog hair that had fallen out. Its face was silky and cold. Please, no petting, Ping Shi said suddenly in the darkness. Natasha took his arm, gushing to him that she was ready for outrage from PETA, a protest or two, an op-ed in the New York Times that would be publicity gold. Ping Shi nodded blankly. I called in sick the day of the opening. Natasha didn't seem to care. She had Angelica fill in at the front desk. She was an anorexic goth, a senior at NYU. The show was a brutal success, one critic called it. Cruelly funny. Another said Ping Shi marked the end of the sacred in art. Here is a spoiled brat taking the piss out of the establishment. Some are hailing him as the next Marcel Duchamp. But is he worth the stink? I don't know why I didn't just quit. I didn't need the money. I was relieved when, at last, in June, Natasha called from Switzerland to fire me. I had messed up a shipment of press materials for Art Basel, apparently. Out of curiosity, what are you on? She wanted to know. I've just been really tired. Is it a medical issue? No, I said. I could have lied. I could have told her that I had mono or some sleep disorder. Cancer, maybe. Everybody was getting cancer. But defending myself was useless. I had no good reason to fight to keep my job. Are you letting me go? I'd love it if you'd stay on until I get back and use the time to show Angelica the ropes, the filing system, whatever you've been doing on the computer, if anything. I hung up the phone, took a handful of Benadryl, and went down to the supply closet and fell asleep. Oh, sleep. Nothing else could ever bring me such pleasure, such freedom, the power to feel and move and think and imagine, safe from the miseries of my waking consciousness. I was not a narcoleptic. I never fell asleep when I didn't want to. I was more of a somniac, a somnophile. I'd always loved sleeping. It was one thing my mother and I had enjoyed doing together when I was a child. She was not the type to sit and watch me draw, or read me books, or play games, or go for walks in the park, or bake brownies. We got along best when we were asleep. When I was in the third grade, my mother, due to some unspoken conflict with my father, let me sleep with her in their bed because, as she said, it was easier to wake me up in the mornings if she didn't have to get up and go across the hall. I accumulated 37 tardies and 24 absences that year. 37 times my mother and I woke up together, bleary and exhausted at 7 a.m., tried to get up, but fell back into bed and slept on while cartoons flashed from the small television on her bedside table. We'd wake up a few hours later, shades drawn, extra pillows lying shipwrecked on the rough beige rug, dress in a daze, and lurch out into the car. I remember her holding one eye open with one hand, steering with the other. I've often wondered what she was on that year, and if she'd been slipping me any of it. 24 times we slept through the alarm, got up sometime past noon, and abandoned the thought of school altogether. I'd eat cereal and read or watch television all day. My mother would smoke cigarettes, talk on the phone, hide from the housekeeper, take a bottle of wine with her into the master bathroom, and draw a bubble bath, and read Danielle Steele, or Better Homes and Gardens. My father slept on the sofa in the den that year. I remember his thick glasses perched on the oak end table, their greasy lenses magnifying the dark grain of the wood. Without his glasses on, I barely recognized him. He was fairly nondescript, thinning brown hair, loosening jowls, a single wrinkle of worry etched deep into his brow. That wrinkle made him look perpetually perplexed, yet passive, like a man trapped behind his own eyes. He was kind of a non-entity, I thought, a stranger gently puppeting his way through his life at home with two strange females he could never hope to understand. Each night, he'd plop an Alka-Seltzer tablet in a glass of water. I stood by as it dissolved. I remember listening to the fizzing sound as he silently removed the cushions from the sofa and stacked them in the corner, his sad, colorless pajamas dragging across the floor. Maybe that's when his cancer started, a few odd cells forming during a bad night's sleep in the living room. My father was neither an ally nor a confidant, but it seemed backward to me that this hard-working man would be relegated to the sofa while my lazy mother got the king-size bed. I resented her for that, but she seemed immune to guilt and shame. I think she got away with so much because she was beautiful. She looked like Lee Miller, if Lee Miller had been a bedroom drunk. I assume she blamed my father for ruining her life. She got pregnant and dropped out of college to marry him. She didn't have to, of course. I was born in August 1973, 7 months after Roe v. Wade. Her family was the country club brand of alcoholic Southern Baptists, Mississippi loggers on one side, Louisiana oilmen on the other, or else, I assumed, she would have aborted me. My father was 12 years older than my mother. She'd been just 19 years old and already 4 months pregnant when they got married. I'd figured that out as soon as I could do the math. Stretch marks, loose skin, scars across her belly, she said looked like a raccoon had disemboweled her, glaring at me as if I'd wrapped my umbilical cord around my neck on purpose. Maybe I did. You were blue when they cut me open and pulled you out. After all the hell I went through, the consequences, your father, and the baby goes and dies? Like dropping a pie on the floor as soon as you pull it out of the oven. The only intellectual exercise my mother got was doing crossword puzzles. She'd come out of the bedroom some nights to ask my father for hints. "Don't tell me the answer, just tell me what the word sounds like," she'd say. As a professor, my father was good at guiding people to their own conclusions. He was dispassionate, sulky, even a little snide at times. I took after him. My mother did say once we were both stone wolves, but she herself had a cold aura too. I don't think she realized it. None of us had much warmth in our hearts. I was never allowed to have any pets. Sometimes I think a puppy might have changed everything. My parents died one after the other my junior year of college. First my dad from cancer, then my mother from pills and alcohol 6 weeks later. All of this, the tragedy of my past, came reeling back with great force that night I woke up in the supply closet at Ducat for the last time. It was 10 at night, and everyone had gone home. I trudged up the dark stairway to clean out my desk. There was no sadness or nostalgia, only disgust that I'd wasted so much time on unnecessary labor when I could have been sleeping and feeling nothing. I'd been stupid to believe that employment would add value to my life. I found a shopping bag in the break room and packed up my coffee mug, the spare change of clothes I kept in my desk drawer, along with a few pairs of high heels, pantyhose, a push-up bra, some makeup, a stash of cocaine I hadn't used in a year. I thought about stealing something from the gallery, the Larry Clark photo hanging in Natasha's office, or the paper cutter. I settled on a bottle of champagne, a lukewarm and therefore appropriate consolation. I turned off all the lights, set the alarm, and walked out. It was a cool, early summer night. I lit a cigarette and stood facing the gallery. The lasers weren't on, but through the glass I could see the tall white poodle that looked out onto the sidewalk. It was baring its teeth, with one gold fang glinting in the light of the street lamp. There was a red velvet bow tied around its little bouffant hairdo. Suddenly, a feeling rose up in me. I tried to squash it down, but it nestled into my bowels. Pets just make messes. I don't want to have to go around picking dog hairs out of my teeth, I remembered my mother saying. Not even a goldfish? Why? Just to watch it swim around and die? Maybe this memory triggered the hemorrhage of adrenaline that pushed me to go back inside the gallery. I pulled a few Kleenex from the box on my old desk, flipped the power switch to turn on the lasers, and stood between the stuffed black lab and the sleeping dachshund. Then I pulled down my pants, squatted, and shat on the floor. I wiped myself and shuffled across the gallery with my pants around my ankles and stuffed the shitty Kleenex into the mouth of that bitchy poodle. That felt like vindication. That was my proper goodbye. I left and caught a cab home and drank the whole bottle of champagne that night and fell asleep on my sofa watching Burglar. Whoopi Goldberg was one reason to stay alive, at least. The next day, I filed for unemployment, which Natasha must have resented, but she never called. I set up a weekly pickup with the laundromat and automatic payments on all my utilities, bought a wide selection of used VHS tapes from the Jewish Women's Council thrift shop on 2nd Avenue, and soon I was hitting the pills hard and sleeping all day and all night with 2 or 3 hour breaks in between. This was good, I thought. I was finally doing something that really mattered. Sleep felt productive. Something was getting sorted out. I knew in my heart, this was perhaps the only thing my heart knew back then, that when I'd slept enough, I'd be okay. I'd be renewed, reborn. I would be a whole new person, every one of my cells regenerated enough times that the old cells were just distant, foggy memories. My past life would be but a dream, and I could start over without regrets, bolstered by the bliss and serenity that I would have accumulated in my year of rest and relaxation. Chapter 2. I'd been seeing Dr. Tuttle once a week, but after I left Ducat, I didn't want to have to make the trek down to Union Square that often. So I told her that I was freelancing in Chicago and could only see her in person once a month. She said we could talk over the phone every week, or not, as long as I gave her post-dated checks for my co-payments in advance. If your insurance asks, say you were here weekly in person, just in case. She never caught on that I was having her call in my refills to my local Rite Aid in Manhattan. She never asked how my work in Chicago was going or what I was doing there. Dr. Tuttle knew nothing about my hibernation project. I wanted her to think I was a nervous wreck, but fully operative, so she'd prescribe whatever she thought might knock me out the hardest. I plunged into sleep full force once this arrangement had been made. It was an exciting time in my life. I felt hopeful. I felt I was on my way to a great transformation. I spent that first week in a soft twilight zone. I didn't leave the apartment at all, not even for coffee. I kept a jar of macadamia nuts by the bed, ate a few whenever I rose to the surface, sucked a bottle of Poland Spring, gravitated to the toilet maybe once a day. I didn't answer the phone. Nobody but Riva ever called me anyway. She left me messages so long and breathless that they got cut off mid-sentence. Usually she called while she was on the Stairmaster at her gym. One night, she came over unannounced. The doorman told her he thought I'd gone out of town. "I've been worried," Riva said, barging in with a bottle of sparkling rosé. "Are you sick? Have you been eating? Did you take time off of work?" "I quit," I lied. "I want to devote more time to my own interests."
"What interests? I didn't know you had interests."
She sounded utterly betrayed. She stumbled a little on her heels. "Are you drunk?"
"You really quit your job?"
she asked, kicking her shoes off and flopping down on the armchair. "I'd rather eat shit than have to work for that cunt one more day," I told her.
"Didn't you say she was married to a prince or something?"
"Exactly," I answered. "But that was just a rumor anyway."
"So you're not sick?"
"I'm resting." I lay down on the sofa to demonstrate.
"That makes sense," Riva said, nodding compliantly,
although I could tell she was suspicious.
"Take some time off and think about your next move. Oprah says we women rush into decisions because we don't have faith that something better will ever come along, and that's how we get stuck in dissatisfying careers and marriages. Amen."
"I'm not making a career move," I started to explain, but I went no further. "I'm taking some time off. I'm going to sleep for a year."
"And how are you going to do that?"
I pulled a vial of Ativan out from between the sofa cushions, unscrewed the cap, and fished out two pills. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Riva squirming. I chewed the pills up, simply to horrify her, swallowed and gagged, then stuffed the vial back between the cushions and lay down and closed my eyes.
"Well, I'm glad you have a life plan, but to be honest," Riva began, "I'm concerned about your health. You've lost at least 3 pounds since you started taking all those medications."
Riva was expert at guessing the weights of things and people.
"What about the long term? Are you going to take pills for the rest of your life?"
"I'm not thinking that far ahead, and I might not live that long." I yawned.
"Don't say that," Riva said. "Look at me. Please."
I blinked my eyes open and turned to face the perfumed haze on the armchair. I squinted and focused. Riva was wearing a dress I recognized from a J. Crew catalog the year before, a raw silk shift in a shade of pink I could only describe as taffy, orange-hued lipstick.
"Don't get defensive, but you're kind of off these days," she said. "You've been sort of distant, and you're just getting thinner and thinner."
I think that bothered Riva more than anything. She must have felt that I was cheating in the game of skinniness, which she had always worked so hard to play. We were about the same height, but I wore a size 2, and Riva wore a 4.
"A 6 when I'm PMSing."
The discrepancy between our bodies was huge in Riva's world.
"I just don't think it's healthy to sleep all day," she said, popping a few sticks of gum in her mouth. "Maybe all you need is a shoulder to cry on. You'd be surprised how much better you'll feel after a good cry. Better than any pill can make you feel."
When Riva gave advice, it sounded as though she were reading a bad made-for-TV movie script.
"A walk around the block could do wonders for your mood," she said. "Aren't you hungry?"
"I'm not in the mood for food," I said, "and I don't feel like going anywhere."
"Sometimes you need to act as if." Dr. Tuttle can probably give you something to get rid of your gum addiction, I told her flatly. They have pills for everything now.
I don't want to get rid of it, Reva replied. And it's not an addiction, it's a habit. And I enjoy chewing gum. It's one of the few things in my life that makes me feel good about myself because I do it for my own pleasure. Gum and the gym, those are like my therapy.
But you could have the medication instead, I argued, and spare your jaw from all that chewing. I didn't really care about Reva's jaw.
Uh-huh, she replied.
She was looking straight at me, but was so entranced by her gum chewing, her mind seemed to drift off. When it returned, she got up and spat her gum out in the kitchen trash can, came back, lay down on the floor, and started doing rhythmic crunches, crinkling the midsection of her dress.
We all have our own ways to cope with stress, she said, and rambled on about the benefits of habitual behaviors. Self-soothing is how she described it. Like meditation.
I yawned, hating her.
Sleeping all the time isn't really going to make you feel any better, she said, because you're not changing anything in your sleep. You're just avoiding your problems.
What problems?
I don't know. You seem to think you have a lot of problems, and I just don't get it. You're a smart girl, Reva said. You can do anything you put your mind to.
She got up and fished in her bag for her lip gloss. I could see her eyeing the sweaty bottle of rosé.
Come out with me tonight, pretty please. My friend Jackie from Pilates is having a birthday party at a gay bar in the village. I wasn't going to go, but if you come with me, it could be fun. It's only 7:30, and it's Friday night. Let's drink this and go out. The night is young!
I'm tired, Reva, I said, peeling the wrapper off the cap of a bottle of NyQuil.
Oh, come on.
You go without me.
You want to stay here and sleep your life away? That's it?
If you knew what would make you happy, wouldn't you do it? I asked her.
See, you do want to be happy. Then why did you tell me that being happy is dumb? She asked. You've said that to me more than once.
Let me be dumb, I said, glugging the NyQuil. You go be smart and tell me how great it is. I'll be here, hibernating. Reva rolled her eyes.
It's natural, I told her. People used to hibernate all the time. People never hibernated. Where are you getting this?
She could look really pathetic when she was outraged. She got up and stood there holding her stupid knockoff Kate Spade bag or whatever it was, her hair pulled back into a ponytail and crowned with a useless plastic tortoiseshell headband. She was always getting her hair blown out, her eyebrows waxed into thin, arched parentheses, her fingernails painted various shades of pink and purple, as though all of this made her a wonderful person. It's not up for discussion, Reva. This is what I'm doing. If you can't accept it, then you don't have to.
I accept it, she said, her voice dropping. I just think it's a shame to miss out on a fun evening.
She wrestled her white feet into her fake Louboutin stilettos.
You know, in Japan, companies have special rooms for businessmen to take naps in. I read about it in GQ. I'll check on you tomorrow. I love you, she said, grabbing the bottle of rosé on her way out.
I dreamt a lot at the beginning, especially when the summer started in full force and the air in my apartment got thick with the sickly chill of AC. Dr. Tuttle said my dreams might indicate how well certain medications were working. She suggested I keep a log of my dreams as a way of tracking the waning intensity of suffering.
I don't like the term dream journal, she told me at our in-person appointment in June. I prefer night vision log.
So I made notes on post-its. Each time I awoke, I scribbled down whatever I could remember. Later, I copied the dreams over in crazier-looking handwriting on a yellow legal pad, adding terrifying details to hand in to Dr. Tuttle in July. My hope was that she'd think I needed more sedation. In one dream, I went to a party on a cruise ship and watched a lone dolphin circling in the distance. But in the dream journal, I reported that I was actually on the Titanic, and the dolphin was a shark that was also Moby Dick, and also Dick Tracy, and also a hard, inflamed penis, and the penis was giving a speech to a crowd of women and children and waving his gun around. Then I saluted everyone like a Nazi and jumped overboard, and everybody else got executed. In another dream, I lost my balance standing in a speeding subway car and accidentally grabbed and ripped the hair off an old woman's head. Her scalp was teeming with larvae, and the larvae were all threatening to kill me. I dreamt I drove a rusted Mercedes up onto the esplanade by the East River. Skinny joggers and Hispanic housekeepers and toy poodles thudding under the tires, and my heart exploded with happiness when I saw all the blood. I dreamt I jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge and found an underwater village abandoned because its inhabitants had heard life was better somewhere else. A fire-breathing serpent disemboweled me and slurped up my entrails. I dreamt I stole somebody's diaphragm and put it in my mouth before giving my doorman a blowjob. I cut off my ear and emailed it to Natasha with a bill for $1 million. I swallowed a live bee. I ate a grenade. I bought a pair of red suede ankle boots and walked down Park Avenue. The gutters were flooded with aborted fetuses. "Tisk, tisk," Dr. Tuttle replied when I showed her the log. "Looks like you're still in the depths of despair. Let's up your sulfaton. But if you have nightmares about inanimate objects coming to life, or if you experience such things while you're awake, discontinue." And then there were the dreams about my parents, which I never mentioned to Dr. Tuttle. I dreamt my dad had an illegitimate son he kept in the closet of his study. I discovered the boy, pale and undernourished, and together we conspired to burn down the house. I dreamt that I lathered up my mother's pubic hair with a bar of ivory soap in the shower, then pulled a tangle of hair out of her vagina. It was like the kind of furball a cat coughs up, or a clog in a bathroom drain. In the dream, I understood that the tangle of hair was my father's cancer. I dreamt that I dragged both my parents' dead bodies down into a ravine, then waited calmly in the moonlight, watching for vultures. In a few dreams, I'd answer the phone and hear a long silence, which I interpreted as my mother's speechless disdain. Or I heard crackling static and cried out, "Mom? Dad?" into the receiver, desperate and devastated that I couldn't hear what they were saying. And other times, I was just reading transcripts of dialogues between the two of them, typed on aging onion skin paper that fell apart in my hands. Occasionally, I'd spot my parents in places like the lobby of my apartment building or on the steps of the New York Public Library. My mother seemed disappointed and rushed, as though the dream had pulled her away from an important task. "What happened to your hair?" she asked me in the Starbucks on Lexington Avenue. Then she trotted down the hall to the restroom. My father was always sick in my dreams, sunken eyes, greasy smudges on the thick lenses of his glasses. Once, he was my anesthesiologist. I was getting breast implants. He put his hand out a little hesitantly for me to shake, as though he wasn't sure who I was or if we'd met before. I lay down on the steel gurney. Those dreams with him were the most upsetting. I'd wake up in a panic, take a few more Roserum or whatever, and go back to sleep. In my waking hours, I often thought about my parents' house, its nooks and corners, the way a room looked in the morning, in the afternoon, in the still of the night during summer, the soft yellow light of the street lamp out front glinting off the polished wooden furniture in the den. The estate lawyer had recommended that I sell the house. The last time I'd been up there was the summer after my parents had died. Trevor and I were in the midst of one of our many failed romantic reunions, so we spent a weekend in the Adirondacks and took a detour to my hometown on the drive back down to the city. Trevor stayed in the rented convertible as I walked around the perimeter of the house, peering through the dusty windows at the empty spaces inside. It hardly looked any different from when I'd lived in it.
"Don't sell until the market improves," Trevor yelled.
I got emotional and embarrassed, ducked away, and jumped in the mucky pond behind the garage, then emerged covered in rotting moss. Trevor got out of the car to hose me off in the garden, made me strip and put on his blazer before getting back into the car.
then asked for a blowjob in the parking lot of the Poughkeepsie Galleria before he went in to buy me a new outfit. I acquiesced. For him, this was erotic gold. When Trevor dropped me off at school, I called the lawyer and told him that I couldn't let go of the house. Not until I'm sure I'll never get married and have children, I said. It wasn't true, and I didn't care about the housing market or how much money I could get. I wanted to hold on to the house the way you'd hold on to a love letter. It was proof that I had not always been completely alone in this world. But I think I was also holding on to the loss, to the emptiness of the house itself, as though to affirm that it was better to be alone than to be stuck with people who were supposed to love you, yet couldn't. There were moments when I was little, my mother could make me feel very special, stroking my hair, her perfume sweet and light, her pale, bony hands cool and jangling with gold bracelets, her frosted hair, her lipstick, breath woody with smoke and stringent from booze. But the next moment she'd be in a haze, distracted, suffering from some grave fear or worry, and struggling to put up with even the thought of me. "I can't listen to you now," she'd say in these moments, and she'd move from room to room, away, looking for some piece of paper where she'd scrawled down a phone number. "If you threw it away, I swear," she'd warn. She was always calling someone, some new friend, I guess. I never knew where she met these women, these new friends. At the beauty parlor? At the liquor store? I could have acted out if I'd wanted to. I could have dyed my hair purple, flunked out of high school, starved myself, pierced my nose, slutted around, what have you. I saw other teenagers doing that, but I didn't really have the energy to go to so much trouble. I did crave attention, but I refused to humiliate myself by asking for it. I'd be punished if I showed signs of suffering, I knew. So, I was good. I did all the right things. I rebelled in silent ways, with my thoughts. My parents barely seemed to notice I existed. Once, I heard them whispering in the hallway while I was using the bathroom. "Did you see she has two blemishes on her chin?" my mother asked my father. "I can't stand to look at them. They're so pink."
"Take her to a dermatologist if you're that concerned," my father said.
A few days later, our housekeeper brought me a tube of Clearasil. It was the tinted kind. At the private all-girls high school I went to, I'd had a flock of Reva-like adorers. I was emulated and gossiped about. I was blonde and thin and pretty. That's what people noticed. That's what those girls cared about. I learned to float on cheap affections gleaned from other people's insecurities. I didn't stay out late. I just did my homework, kept my room clean, bided my time until I could move out and grow up and feel normal, I hoped. I didn't go out with boys until college, until Trevor. When I was applying to schools, I overheard my mother talking to my father about me one more time.
"You should read her college essay," said my mother. "She'll never let me look at it. I'm worried she might try to do something creative. She'll end up at some awful state school."
"I've had some very bright graduate students who went to state schools," my father replied calmly. "And if she just wants to major in English or something like that, it doesn't really matter where she goes."
In the end, I did show my college essay to my mother. I didn't tell her that Anton Kirschler, the artist I wrote about, was a character of my own invention. I wrote that his work was instructive for how to maintain a humanistic approach to art facing the rise of technology. I described various made-up pieces: dog urinating on computer, stock market hamburger lunch. I wrote that his work spoke to me personally because I was interested in how art created the future. It was a mediocre essay. My mother seemed unperturbed by it, which shocked me, and handed it back with the suggestion that I look up a few words in the thesaurus because I'd repeated them too often. I didn't take her advice. I applied to Columbia Early Decision and got in. On the eve of my move to New York, my parents sat me down to talk.
"Your mother and I understand that we have a certain responsibility to prepare you for life at a co-ed institution," said my father. "Have you ever heard of oxytocin?"
I shook my head. It's the thing that's going to make you crazy, my mother said, swirling the ice in her glass. You'll lose all the good sense I've worked so hard to build up in you since the day you were born. She was kidding.
Oxytocin is a hormone released during copulation,
my father went on, staring at the blank wall behind me.
Orgasm,
my mother whispered.
Biologically, oxytocin serves a purpose, my father said.
That warm, fuzzy feeling.
It's what bonds a couple together. Without it, the human species would have gone extinct a long time ago. Women experience its effects more powerfully than men do. It's good to be aware of that.
For when you're thrown out with yesterday's trash, my mother said. Men are dogs, even professors, so don't be fooled.
Men don't attach as easily. They're more rational,
my father corrected her. After a long pause, he said,
We just want you to be careful.
He means use a rubber.
And take these.
My father gave me a small, pink, shell-shaped compact of birth control pills. Gross, was all I could say.
And your father has cancer, my mother said.
I said nothing.
Prostate isn't like breast, my father said, turning away. They do surgery and you move on.
The man always dies first,
my mother whispered. My dad's chair screeched on the floor as he pushed himself away from the table.
I was only teasing,
my mom said, batting the smoke of her own cigarette away from her face.
About the cancer?
No. That was the end of the conversation. Later, while I packed up to move into the dorm, my mother came and stood in the doorway of my bedroom, holding her cigarette out behind her in the hall as if it would make any difference. The whole house always smelled like stale smoke.
You know I don't like it when you cry, she said.
I wasn't crying, I said.
And I hope you're not packing any shorts. Nobody wears shorts in Manhattan. And they'll shoot you in the street if you go around in those disgusting tennis shoes. You'll look ridiculous. Your father isn't paying this much for you to go look ridiculous in New York City.
I wanted her to think that I was crying over my father's cancer, but that wasn't quite it.
Well, goddammit, if you insist on getting weepy, my mother said, turning to leave. You know, when you were a baby, I crushed Valium into your bottle. You had colic and cried for hours and hours, inconsolable and for no good reason. And change your shirt. I can see the sweat under your arms. I'm going to bed.
A realty company managed my parents' property after they were dead. The house got rented out to a history professor and his family. I never had to meet them. The company handled the maintenance and gardening and made any repairs necessary. When something broke or wore out, they sent me a letter with a photo and an estimate. When I got lonely or bored or nostalgic, I'd go through the photos and try to disgust myself with the banality of the place. A cracked step, a leak in the basement, a peeling ceiling, a broken cabinet. And I'd feel sorry for myself, not because I missed my parents, but because there was nothing they could have given me if they'd lived. They weren't my friends. They didn't comfort me or give me good advice. They weren't people I wanted to talk to. They barely even knew me. They were too busy to want to imagine my life in Manhattan. My father was busy dying. Within a year of his diagnosis, the cancer had spread to his pancreas, then his stomach, and my mother busy being herself, which in the end seemed worse than having cancer. She visited me just once in New York, my sophomore year. She took the train down and was an hour late to meet me at the Guggenheim. I could smell alcohol on her breath as we wandered around. She was skittish and quiet.
Oh, isn't that pretty?
She said about a Kandinsky, a Chagall. She left me abruptly when we got to the top of the ramp, saying she'd lost track of time. I followed her down and out of the museum, watched her try to hail a cab, seething and flabbergasted when each passing taxi was occupied. I don't know what her problem was. Maybe she'd seen a piece of art that unnerved her. She never explained it. But she called me later from her hotel and had me meet her for dinner that evening.
It was as if nothing strange had happened at the museum. She was accountable for nothing when she was drunk. I was used to it. I paid for my apartment on East 84th Street in cash from my inheritance. From the windows in the living room, I could see some of Carl Schurr's park and a sliver of the East River. I could see the nannies with their strollers. Wealthy housewives milled up and down the esplanade in visors and sunglasses. They reminded me of my mother, pointless and self-obsessed. Only she had been less physically active. If I leaned out my bedroom window, I could see the uppermost tip of Roosevelt Island with its weird geometry of low brick buildings. I liked to think those buildings housed the criminally insane, though I knew that wasn't the case, at least anymore. Once I started sleeping full-time, I didn't look out my windows very often. A glimpse was all I ever wanted. The sun rose in the east and set in the west. That hadn't changed, and it never would. The speed of time varied, fast or slow, depending on the depth of my sleep. I became very sensitive to the taste of the water from the tap. Sometimes it was cloudy and tasted of soft minerals. Other times it was gassy and tasted like somebody's bad breath. My favorite days were the ones that barely registered. I'd catch myself not breathing, slumped on the sofa, staring at an eddy of dust tumbling across the hardwood floor in the draft, and I'd remember that I was alive for a second, then fade back out. Achieving that state took heavy doses of Seroquel, or lithium combined with Xanax, and Ambien or Trazodone, and I didn't want to overuse those prescriptions. There was a fine mathematics for how to mete out sedation. The goal for most days was to get to a point where I could drift off easily and come to without being startled. My thoughts were banal. My pulse was casual. Only the coffee made my heart work a bit harder. Caffeine was my exercise. It catalyzed my anxiety so that I could crash and sleep again. The movies I cycled through the most were The Fugitive, Frantic, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Burglar. I loved Harrison Ford and Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi Goldberg was my main hero. I spent a lot of time staring at her on screen and picturing her vagina. Solid, honest, magenta. I owned VHS copies of all her movies, but many of them were too powerful to watch often. The Color Purple was too sad. Ghost filled me with too much longing, and Whoopi only had a small part in it. Sister Act was tricky because the songs got stuck in my head and made me want to laugh, run wild, dance, be impassioned, or whatnot. That would not be good for my sleep. I could only handle it once a week or so. I usually watched Soap Dish and The Player back to back, as though they were two volumes of a single film. On my visits to Rite Aid to pick up my pills, I'd buy a pre-owned VHS tape, maybe a box of microwave popcorn, sometimes a 2-liter bottle of Diet Sprite if I felt I had the strength to carry it home. Those cheap movies were usually terrible. Showgirls, Enemy of the State, I'll Be Home for Christmas, starring Jonathan Taylor Thomas, whose face unnerved me, but I didn't mind watching them once or twice. The stupider the movie, the less my mind had to work. But I preferred the familiar. Harrison Ford and Whoopi Goldberg doing what they always do. When I went to see Dr. Tuttle in early August for my monthly in-person visit, she wore a white sleeveless nightgown with tattered lace across her bosom and huge honey-tinted sunglasses with blinders. She still had the neck brace on. "I had a procedure done on my eyes," she explained, "and the central air has sprung a leak. Excuse the humidity." Sweat bubbled across her chest and arms like blisters. Her hair frizzed up and out. The fat cats lay on the fainting sofa. "They're overheated," Dr. Tuttle said. "Better not disturb them." There was no place else to sit, so I stood against the bookshelf, bracing myself and taking shallow breaths. The smell of ammonia in the room was intense. It seemed to be coming from the cats. "Did you bring your book of nightmares?" Dr. Tuttle asked, sitting down behind her desk. "I forgot my journal today," I said. "The nightmares have been getting worse and worse, though." I lied. My dreams had actually mellowed. "Tell me about one of them, just so I can update my file,"
Dr. Tuttle said, pulling out a folder. She seemed harried and hot, but she was not disorganized. Well, I mined my mind for something disturbing. All I could recall were the plots of the terrible movies I'd recently seen. I had this one nightmare where I moved to Las Vegas and met a seamstress and gave lap dances. Then I ran into an old friend who gave me a floppy disk full of government secrets, and I became a suspect in a murder case, and the NSA chased me, and instead of getting a Porsche for Christmas, a football team left me stranded in the desert. Dr. Tuttle scribbled dutifully, then lifted her head, waiting for more. So I started eating sand to try to kill myself instead of dying of dehydration. It was awful. Very troubling, Dr. Tuttle murmured. I wobbled against the bookshelf. It was difficult to stay upright. 2 months of sleep had made my muscles wither, and I could still feel the trazodone I'd taken that morning. Try to sleep on your side when possible. There was recently a study in Australia that said that when you sleep on your back, you're more likely to have nightmares about drowning. It's not conclusive, of course, since they're on the opposite side of the earth, so actually, you might want to try sleeping on your stomach instead and see what that does. Dr. Tuttle, I began, I was wondering if you could prescribe something a little stronger for bedtime. When I'm tossing and turning at night, I get so frustrated. It's like I'm in hell. Hell? I can give you something for that, she said, reaching for her prescription pad. Mind over matter, people say, but what is matter anyway? When you look at it under a microscope, it's just tiny bits of stuff. Atomic particles, subatomic particles. Look deeper and deeper, and eventually you'll find nothing. We're mostly empty space. We're mostly nothing. Tra-la-la. And we're all the same nothingness. You and me, just filling the space with nothingness. We could walk through walls if we put our minds to it, people say. What they don't mention is that walking through a wall would most likely kill you. Don't forget that. I'll keep it in mind. Dr. Tuttle handed me the prescriptions. Here, have some samples, she said, pushing a basket of promaxetine toward me. Oh, no, wait. These are for impotent obsessive compulsives. They'd keep you up at night. She pulled the basket back. See you in a month. I took a cab home, filled the new prescriptions, and refilled the old ones at Rite Aid, bought a pack of Skittles, and went home and ate the Skittles and a few leftover Primadone, and went back to sleep. The next day, Reva came over to whine about her dying mother and prattle on about Ken. Her drinking seemed to be getting worse that summer. She pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo and a can of Diet Mountain Dew from her new huge lime-green alligator skin knockoff Gucci tote.
Want some tequila?
I shook my head no. Reva had an interesting method of mixing her drinks. After each sip of Diet Mountain Dew, she'd pour a little Jose Cuervo into the can to take up the space her sip had displaced, so that by the time she finished, she was drinking straight tequila. It was fascinating to me. I caught myself imagining the ratio of Diet Mountain Dew to Jose Cuervo in that can, what the formula would be to measure it sip by sip. I'd studied Zeno's paradox in high school algebra, but never fully understood it. Infinite divisibility, the theory of halving, whatever it was. That philosophical quandary was exactly the kind of thing Trevor would have loved to explain to me. He'd sit across from me at dinner, slurping his ice water, muttering fluently about fractions of cents and the fluctuating price of oil, for example, all while his eyes scanned the room behind me as though to affirm to me that I was stupid, I was boring. Someone far better might be getting up from a table to go powder her nose. The thought stung. I still couldn't accept that Trevor was a loser and a moron. I didn't want to believe that I could have degraded myself for someone who didn't deserve it. I was still stuck on that bit of vanity. But I was determined to sleep it away.
You're still obsessed with Trevor, aren't you?
Reva said, slurping from her can. I think I have a tumor, I replied. In my brain.
Forget Trevor, Reva said. You'll meet someone better, if you ever leave your apartment.
She sipped and poured and went on about how
it's all about your attitude, and that positive thinking is more powerful than negative thinking, even in equal amounts.
She'd recently read a book called How to Attract the Man of Your Dreams Using Self-Hypnosis, and so she went on to explain to me the difference between wish fulfillment and manifesting your own reality. I tried not to listen.
Your problem is that you're passive. You wait around for things to change, and they never will. That must be a painful way to live, very disempowering, she said, and burped.
I had taken some Risperdal. I was feeling woozy. Have you ever heard the expression, eat shit or die? I asked. Reva unscrewed the tequila and poured more into her can.
It's eat shit and die, she said.
We didn't talk for a while. My mind drifted back to Trevor, the way he unbuttoned his shirts and pulled at his tie, the gray drapes in his bedroom, the flare of his nostrils in the mirror when he clipped his nose hairs, the smell of his aftershave. I was grateful when Reva broke the silence.
Well, will you come out for drinks on Saturday at least? It's my birthday.
I can't, Reva, I said. I'm sorry.
I'm telling people to meet up at Skinny Kitty at 9-ish.
I'm sure you'll have a better time if I'm not there to bum you out.
Don't be that way, Reva crooned drunkenly. Soon we'll be old and ugly. Life is short, you know? Die young and leave a beautiful corpse. Who said that?
Someone who liked fucking corpses. Reva was only a week older than me. On August 20th, 2000, I turned 25 in my apartment in a medicated haze, smoking stale menthols on the toilet and reading an old architectural digest. At some point, I fumbled in my makeup drawer for eyeliner to circle things on the pages that I found appealing, the blank corners of rooms, the sharp glass crystals hanging from a chandelier. I heard my cell phone ring, but I didn't answer it.
Happy birthday, Reva said in her message. I love you.
As summer dwindled, my sleep got thin and empty, like a room with white walls and tepid air conditioning. If I dreamt at all, I dreamt that I was lying in bed. It felt superficial, even boring at times. I'd take a few extra Risperdal and Ambien when I got antsy, thinking about my past. I tried not to think of Trevor. I deleted Reva's messages without listening to them. I watched Air Force One 12 times on mute. I tried to put everything out of my mind. Valium helped. Ativan helped. Chewable melatonin and Benadryl and NyQuil and Lunesta and Temazepam helped. My visit to Dr. Tuttle in September was also banal. Besides the sweltering heat I suffered walking from my building into a cab and from the cab into Dr. Tuttle's office, I felt almost nothing. I wasn't anxious or despondent or resentful or terrified. How are you feeling? I stood and pondered the question for 5 minutes while Dr. Tuttle went around her office, turning on an arsenal of fans, all the same make and model, two installed on the radiator under the windows, one on her desk, and two in the corners of the room on the floor. She was impressively nimble. She no longer wore the neck brace.
I'm fine, I think,
I yelled blandly over the roaring hum.
You look pale, Dr. Tuttle remarked.
I've been keeping out of the sun, I told her.
Good thing. Sun exposure promotes cellular collapse, but nobody wants to talk about that.
She herself was a piglety shade of pink. She wore a straw-colored sack of a dress that looked like coarse linen. Her hair was at a high frizz. A tight, chunky strand of pearls rolled up and down her throat as she spoke. The fans stirred up a roar of wind and made me dizzy. I gripped the bookshelf, knocking a swollen copy of Apparent Death to the floor.
Sorry,
I yelled over the din and picked it up.
An interesting book about possums. Animals have so much wisdom.
Dr. Tuttle paused.
I hope you're not a vegetarian, she said, lowering her glasses. I'm not.
That's a relief. Now tell me how you feel. Your affect is very flat today, Dr. Tuttle said.
She was right. I could barely arouse the enthusiasm to stand up straight.
Have you been taking your Risperdal?
I skipped yesterday. I was so busy at work, I just forgot.